Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last, the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This February 10th, 2015 edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Aphrazin, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the next one, is provided by Scottish teenager Rhiann Farrigan. Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the mainstream echo chamber, and we'll mention a couple stories. First, Guy, what do you have?
Thanks, Mike. From Washington's blog yesterday, February 9th, comes a story headlined, 42 Admitted False Flag Attacks. I'll quote from the story. There are many documented false flag attacks where a government carries out a terror attack and then falsely blames its enemy for political purposes. In the following 42 instances, officials in the government which carried out the attack or seriously proposed an attack admit to it, either orally or in writing. The story goes on to tell the 42 examples. Of the 42 examples involving nearly 20 countries, more than a dozen involve the U.S. But these are merely examples, not a full accounting of the U.S. involvement in initiating false flag attacks for political purposes. And the story concludes, the term comes from the old days of wooden ships, where one ship would hang the flag of its enemy before attacking another ship. Because the enemy's flag, instead of the flag of the real country of the attacking ship, was hung, it was called a false flag attack. Indeed, this concept is so well accepted that rules of engagement for naval, air, and land warfare all prohibit false flag attacks. So there you have it. They're prohibited under the rules of warfare, but the hits keep coming. And the American populace keeps falling for it. Apparently, the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history.
Well, I think people just write it off as a conspiracy theory.
Yes, a term popularized by the CIA in the wake of World War II to disparage those people who are interested in conspiracy facts.
Great. Well, and the good news continues. My news comes from an op-ed news.com piece, and it's by future guest Dr. Mary Piper. And it's titled, The Psychological Moment We Are In. And the article discusses the idea that we are not evolutionarily equipped to handle the flow of information we have today as a species. In fact, our guest today will also address this idea of our inability to handle such vast amounts of allurements. In the article, she goes on to mention, daily we are bombarded with horrific information. She mentions things like bombings, school shootings, beheadings, terrorists, and so on. The information is no longer proximal, but global in scale. Instead, we used to have small communities that dealt with very local issues, such as crops, births, and just local gossip. Today, we are, in fact, overloaded, overwhelmed with a global community, and we freeze because of being overwhelmed. Our core state is being overwhelmed, and we are bombarded by too much information, too many choices, too much complexity. We have mammalian arousal systems, Neolithic brains, medieval institutions, and 21st century technology and communications. Our biorhythms have become entrained with machines. We operate in nanosecond time, and we struggle with slowing down, staying calm, and relaxing. In our individualistic culture, we tend to view our distress as personal. How are we as humans reacting to this? We are vulnerable to addictions, compulsions, and anxiety attacks. We leave a great deal of our experience unprocessed and unspoken. We withdraw from the world, we compartmentalize, we deny, and we experience psychic numbing. So, how can we become healthy and awake? We can do some by gating some of the information and balancing our desire to be informed with our need for self-protection. We can find wholesome ways to slow ourselves down, such as yoga, music, reading, meditation, and time in the natural world. We can stay deeply engaged with the world that is touchable, and we can savor homemade stew and laugh with our friends, hug our children, and feel the sun and wind and rain on our faces. So those are some of the suggestions that she makes, and for me personally, a lot of these things really help me deal with what's going on. I can become overwhelmed, obviously, with the social media and all the news that crosses my quote-unquote timeline, but I find that if I actually just kind of filter some of that and not take everything to heart and personally, it makes life a lot more comfortable.
Well, yeah, so the article is pointing out what a relatively large amount of people are catching on to lately, and that's that it's an overwhelming world. We're overwhelmed with information. It's the so-called information age and has been for 20 years. And yet almost everybody I know wants more, more of everything.
Right.
As if overwhelming isn't enough. By the way, the word whelming means exactly the same thing as overwhelming. So you're overstating the case when you say overwhelmed, but whatever.
Well, the thing is, and it's odd because I do this myself, that how we take things that are, I don't know, maybe global in scale or sometimes across the ocean from us, and we take them very personally, and we let them affect us in the way we live our lives. We go around and we literally become depressed by certain things that on some levels we have a connection to, but not a personal connection.
Right, and we see that every day. People personifying, taking personally and integrating personally things such as the demise of our species,
right,
such as the collapse of industrial civilization, such as the jobs report. You know, of course, it's easy to take all those things personally when you are at some level affected, and that effect is personal. But come on, really? It's not like your individual behaviors are going to turn any of those things around. And so maybe you shouldn't take it so personally.
Yeah.
Unless you happen to be pulling the strings of industry working for the big banks or the CIA. But wait, that's probably not our audience.
No.
NSA? Are you out there?
Really hard to stay present when that's going on.
Yes, absolutely right.
All right, what do we got next, guys?
Okay, on to real or fake news. In this segment, we provide a headline, and you guess whether it's from the mainstream media or an organization such as The Onion. And I had a story all picked out and ready to go, but then Mike and I went to coffee with our neighbors this morning. There were 11 of us in attendance, with 47-year-old Mike being the youngest person there. Our host is 97, about to turn 98, in fact. So, Mike, you have a better memory than I do. Why don't you relate a couple of the stories, because this is real news in almost real time.
Well, I don't know what kind of program this is. So, one of the stories that was related this morning was really one of the better things I've heard in a while. We have a neighbor who has someone she knows who plays cello. And I guess from what I gather, and this is actually, we'll just give it away, this is real news.
Yeah.
The porn industry pays well for background music, and apparently cello players. And so this particular person was hired and did his part to play and was walking by a theater which was playing the movie where his music was being in the background, I guess, placed in the background.
And by the way, if that was me and they were playing my music,
right,
I'd walk right in. Right? I'd want to know how it was presented.
Right, right. Was it picked up well? Was it received well? And so there was only one other person in the theater, and during the movie, I guess there was a particular scene where there was a person having relations, we'll put it, with a dog. And so the movie ended, and the two individuals walked out, and the cello player turned to the guy and said, yeah, that was my cello in the movie. And the other guy said, that was my dog.
You couldn't make make this up.
He couldn't make it up. That's the kind of coffee conversation that we have out here in
Yeah, with people who are in their 80s and 90s. All shackles have been thrown off long ago.
Right.
I love how the conversation started with two people who voted in different directions for the school board election.
Right, the vital school board election.
The all-vital school board election. And so the guy who supported the winner pointed out that his guy had won.
In a landslide.
It wasn't even close.
Right.
And so what did she say, the woman who supported the other person?
She said, well, I hope you can live with the consequences.
This is big stuff. Big stuff, yeah.
Again, very local.
Yeah, absolutely. All politics is local.
Right. It wasn't so global, we weren't overwhelmed.
This week we have the pleasure of interviewing Michael Dowd. Michael Dowd, a.k.a. Reverend Reality, is a best-selling evolutionary theologian and climate hawk whose work has been featured in the New York Times, the L.A. Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Newsweek, Discover, and on television nationally. His book, Thank God for Evolution, was endorsed by 6 Nobel Prize-winning scientists, noted skeptics, and by religious leaders across the spectrum. Michael and his science writer wife, Connie Barlow, have spoken to more than 2,000 groups across North America since 2002. He's delivered 2 TEDx talks, a presentation at the United Nations, and most recently he interviewed 55 climate, peak oil, and sustainability experts as part of an online conversation series titled The Future is Calling Us to Greatness. Thank you, Michael Dowd, for spending time with us today on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Guy. Good to be here. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Sorry I had to follow the porno story there.
No, that's okay.
It's hard to get better press than that, though. Let's be fair.
Let's be fair. You and your wife, Connie, travel around the country, and you speak, and you give a lot of presentations, and you have what I would consider, and I'm sure what you would consider to have, important dialogue that's going on with these communities that you visit. And my wife and I also live what I would call a semi-nomadic lifestyle, and we've learned a great deal from being on the road and entering people's lives. And I was wondering if you could speak about your experiences of just kind of being out there amongst the people and coming into these communities and talking with them.
Yeah, sure, be happy to. Well, it's been an amazing journey. We've done this now. It'll be 13 years in April that we've traveled the continent, speaking in religious and non-religious settings of all kinds, every denomination practically, and non-religious, non-Christian groups and secular groups and that sort of thing. And we focus on the sacred side of science. We focus on the inspiring side of what evidence is bringing. And living with people in their homes, because we don't have an RV, we not only do not have a home or an apartment, so we don't have any place we cycle back to, but we don't even have an RV. So we live with people in their homes. For the first 8 years, it was, every 3 to 7 days we were in somebody else's home. The last several years, it's been like every 3 to 7 weeks, and we usually have somebody's home without them there now. So we've got enough people that have offered us a second home or vacation home. And it is amazing to talk to people about, sort of things that really matter, the world, our future, what kind of a future we have, what are we scared about, what are we doing at any level that we're doing it. And most of the folks we interact with really have a valuing of science and a valuing of evidence. So it's been an amazing lifestyle. And we, even though we're technically homeless, we actually have the subjective experience, the felt experience that we're the richest people in the world because we're doing what we love to do, what we have the most passion and energy for. We're in the middle of our bliss, to use Joseph Campbell language. And we're doing some stuff at a time in history that's terrifying and exciting and the work that we do is sort of plays to our gifts. So we both really love what we're doing, and we've built a fairly successful ministry, if you want to call it that, focusing on. And the last 2 years, of course, we've really focused on climate change, and that's gone from back burner to front burner. So now it's pretty much all encompassing is our future, and specifically, most importantly, I think, or most immediately, climate change.
Right. Well, I mean, Guy and I have had similar experiences. Guy travels all over the world, and he stays with people. He stays with his host. And my wife and I have done a fair amount of working on different properties, worldwide opportunities on organic farms. We've done a lot of house sitting, there's something to be said about going to a place and just showing up to a venue, but showing up to someone's house and spending time with them, if possible, and getting to know them and their
Absolutely.
There's a big difference in that, isn't there?
It's a huge difference. It really is. And it changes the pace of everything. We almost never stay in hotels and motels. We almost never fly, especially now because we're just committed to having as low a carbon footprint as possible. And we interact with people. Now, fortunately, they realize that, you know, that the two of us are very mission-driven people. So they don't, you know, we're not required to interact with them a lot. We don't share meals with them, all meals. We share a few. And, you know, Connie, when we're in people's homes with them, you know, we'll share a kitchen. But it is amazing because it doesn't take long to get to some really deep, heartful, you know, stuff that people are dealing with and that they and their kids and grandkids and their concerns. So, yeah, it's amazing. We love this way of living.
Yeah, in my experience, anyway, people really want to have these conversations, and they feel like there's not very many people they can have them with.
Exactly.
So they go about their daily lives, and they go to work, and maybe they go to church, or they're involved in some other group, and they feel like there's bounds on the conversations they can have.
Exactly. Yeah, and I don't, you know, Connie's a little more introverted, but I don't shy away from sort of the really important conversations. In fact, whenever I'm with anybody that I care about or love, whether it's family or friend or whatever, I always treat it as if this could be my last conversation with them. I love having, you know, keeping the end in mind, keeping my mortality in mind. Guy, what you do so powerfully, keeping, you know, our species end in mind. I mean, whether we in fact go extinct in the next 50 to 100 years or whether we, you know, some remnant of humanity survives, as I think there's at least a decent chance, having the end in mind, having our mortality and our species mortality in mind just heightens the sacredness of this moment and this interaction with this person, let's not waste our time talking about superficial stuff. Let's get real.
Yeah, maybe it's just me and my approach to having conversation. But you mentioned that you like to treat each conversation as if it's the last you're going to have with somebody.
Yeah,
in my case, that's frequently the case, actually. Maybe just me.
I don't know. He's socially awkward.
Yeah, I mean, I don't often voice that because I don't want people to feel weird about it. But, like, you know, I just was with my daughter just yesterday, and I hadn't seen her in many, many months. And she's gone through some stuff. And, you know, she was able to share her life story with me. That's the first time. My 31-year-old daughter sharing her life story, that was, like, amazingly sacred. And then when we said goodbye, I said, you know, I mean, I hope that both of us live many, many more years, but I don't want to take it for granted. And so I said goodbye to her with the sense that in case something happens to her or to Connie and I as, you know, we travel or whatever, that I just, you know, told her how much I loved her and this sort of thing. And, you know, both of us teared up. And there's something that brings, it's like the same thing with reminding myself. I went through very serious cancer 5 years ago. And by keeping my mortality, the fact that I'm going to soon be everlastingly dead, no matter how many more decades I might be graced to live, keeping that in mind allows me to prioritize my life. So I don't put off stuff, and I do what's important.
Yeah, I mean, you stay very present.
Exactly.
And, you know, and it's odd. I really didn't grasp the concept of being present or that I was not present in my own life really until I started traveling a little bit.
Sure, sure.
And I went to Nicaragua, and then shortly a few years after, I went to Uganda. And I think that's the first thing I noticed was when people asked how you were doing, they really meant it.
Right, exactly.
They expected an answer. They didn't expect some sort of, yeah, I'm great.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm doing great. Yeah, how about you, you know?
You know, they're looking in your eyes, and they're holding your hand, and, you know, they want an answer, and they want a genuine answer. And
right.
So that was the first experience that I had with, like, whoa, this is, I'm not used to this.
Exactly.
I don't do this. And it was, at first it was very uncomfortable, but boy, as I've grown older, it's just so much more fulfilling to actually skip the small talk in some sense.
Absolutely. I'm with you.
I watched a couple of your TEDx talks and the mission and your message, and I'm going to quote you here. Reality is my God. Evidence is my scripture. Big history is my creation story. Ecology is my theology. Integrity is my salvation. And ensuring a just and healthy future is my mission. You said this is your creed. I was just wondering, how has that had an impact on the variety of different audiences you speak to, because I'm sure that particular mission, you get a variety of reactions.
I do, but virtually all the reactions are on the positive side of things. It's only a matter of how enthusiastic people are. But usually, whether I speak in Christian, Catholic, or Protestant, or even the rare occasion an evangelical church, or whether I'm speaking to Unitarian Universalists, that I've done a lot of that, you know, or Quakers, or you know, even occasionally a Buddhist meditation center or whatever. Most people, in my experience, are craving not only the kind of deeper conversations that we're talking about, but also a way of making sense of our current predicament and, you know, how to move forward. And, you know, as Joanna Macy, the subtitle of her book, Act of Hope, how to face the mess we're in without going crazy. And so when I articulate those 6 points, it's usually in the context of saying something along the lines of, you know, we're at a place now where it's not about beliefs. It's not about having the same beliefs, the same metaphysics, the same theology or philosophy. It's about having the same values, the set of core commitments related to doing whatever we can to foster a just and healthy future. And the way to do that is to live in right relationship to reality, whether we use secular or religious language for that. And these 6 points that you just articulated, you know, I speak it as a creed, but it really is something. There are 6 points that unite tens of millions of secular and religious people around the world. And I can sometimes say it in a secular or religious way or a combination. In fact, I'll show how both could be done. So one way is very similar to what you say, is, you know, reality is my God and evidence is my scripture. Or to use the collective, reality is our God and evidence is our scripture. Big history is our creation story and ecology is our theology. Integrity is our spiritual path, and ensuring or fostering it, I don't think we can ensure, but fostering a just and healthy future is our mission. Now, secular people wouldn't necessarily use those religious words. They might say reality is my ultimate commitment. Evidence is the main way reality reveals itself, and that sort of thing. Or conservative religious people might feel more comfortable with language, and they do in my experience, more like my God includes reality, my scripture includes evidence, my theology includes ecology, and so on. But back to your question, the reception's been hugely positive because I think, again, most people are craving, wherever they are in the religious or philosophical spectrum, they're craving a bridge-building message that lets us, not just lets us, but almost kicks our butts into getting in action with people of very different beliefs, backgrounds, philosophies, and metaphysics so that we can do what we can, or at least try to do what we can, to move this self-destructive and future-destructive culture in some kind of a healthy way, even recognizing that there may only be a remnant that survives. I mean, I don't think we can save Western civilization. I don't think we can save the fact that we are in overshoot, as William Catton talks about, and you and others do. You know, that we're in a situation where we have been out of right relationship to reality, whether you use God language or not. We've been out of right relationship to reality in a severe way for a couple hundred years now, and there are consequences to that. There's a great reckoning. Now, whether or not it turns out to be the great homecoming, that is kind of like the prodigal species where humanity, we've squandered our inheritance, we're hopefully waking up to our predicament in the pig pen, as it were, and coming home to reality, whether that's in fact the case or whether we've triggered, you know, an end of Permian-like extinction because of the, you know, the methane releases and all, the only time will tell. But I know that either way, doing the work that I do and the way that I do it with this amazing woman that I'm married to, because her, of course, legacy is all about assisting trees in migrating north. Whether humanity makes it or not, her commitment is to do, you know, to assist trees in migrating north, because now, without the passenger pigeon, and if they're not wind dispersed, climate is changing too rapidly for most trees to move north. Any tree that relies on an animal to move its seeds. So Connie, my wife, Connie Barlow, is one of the world's sort of point people in the whole field of assisted migration. So this is great work to be done, whether humanity survives or not.
You're listening to Nature Bath Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. We're honored to be joined today by Michael Dowd.
Michael, in your TEDx talk, Why We Struggle Now, and you say when you use the word God, you mean a mythic name or a personification for reality. Could you expand upon the personification?
Yeah, sure. I think, frankly, that personification, to sum it up in a word, is the single most important scientific discovery about religion in the last 100 years. I mean, that's what religions do, is they have an I-thou. They facilitate an I-thou relationship, at least in their healthy forms, an I-thou relationship, a personal relationship with reality. You know, the word reality didn't exist 2 or 3,000 years ago. So what we call reality, if you lived in a polytheistic culture, they called it the gods. And there was a different personification for various aspects of reality. You know, the Helios was the personification of the sun. Helios was not the god of the sun. Helios was not the spirit of the sun. Helios was a personification of the sun. Gaia was a personification of Earth. Eros was a personification of love or lust. So if you don't get personification, that is our brain's inherent propensity to personify, you can't possibly understand the world's myths and religions. And so I often say that, you know, that any use of the word God is trivial and impotent if it's not a personification of reality. So God is is reality with a personality, not a person outside reality. And the challenge is that many people start with some concept of God in mind, and then they try to claim that that God is real. So to claim that God is real means you're starting with some concept of what God is and then claiming it's real. I don't think that's true. I don't think God is real. I think reality is God. That is reality. What's inescapably real whether we believe it or not, like time is real whether we believe it or not, nature is real whether we believe it or not. You know, these are real. Mystery is real. So what does it mean to live in right relationship with time, nature, and mystery? Well, we're right now betraying the future. We're betraying the past as well, so we're living out of right relationship to that aspect of reality, time. We're living out of right relationship to nature. Clearly, we're using the air, water, soil as a garbage can. And we're also living out of right relationship to mystery because honoring mystery is to say that we don't have all the answers. No tradition has all the answers. Any tradition that tries to claim that it has all the answers is betraying mystery. So that's why I think that our only hope, if we do have any hope, our only hope as individuals or collectives is to come home to reality, come into right relationship to reality. And that, to use secular language, that means living in integrity. We need as a species to live in integrity. We need as individuals and groups to live in integrity, that is to live in right relationship to reality. And one of the main ways reality shows up is limits, constraints, you know. This idea of limitlessness is collective insanity, I think. I mean, it betrays the fact that there are concrete biological, ecological, physical limits that if we don't live in right relationship to reality with, we will be broken on those laws. We don't break those laws.
But this culture persists on the basis of an assumption that we can have infinite growth, that there are no limits. In fact, the banking system we have, the fractional reserve banking system we have, the political system we have, these assume that infinite growth is a given, and not only that, but that infinite growth with no adverse consequences is a given.
No, Guy, I'm 100% with you. I mean, there's just absolutely no question that the current system, the way we have structured ourselves globally now as humans, because of what began as a Western tradition is now the whole world, you know, it's collectively insane. It's leading us down a path to literally to hell and high water. But when you step back and look at it from a cosmic perspective, like if you compress the 13.82 billion year history of the universe, let's round it off to 14. You compress the 14 billion year history of the universe into 100 years. At that time scale, humans have only existed for the last day. You know, Homo sapiens, the last day of a 100 year process. You've got 99 years, 364 days. The last day is symbolic speaking humans. So that's the last, 400,000 years. But really, the kinds of things you just pointed to are only the last minute on the cosmic century timeline, the last 250 years. So yes, we are so wildly out of sync with the way nature, the way reality really is, that there is going to be a tremendous die-off. There's going to be a tremendous, there's just nothing that we can do to stop it in its entirety. But we can also, what we do in the next 10 to 20 years, for example, if we tax carbon or if we don't, you know, if we marshal the power of the market to help us move in the right direction, I mean, we can make things, by what we do or don't do in the next 20 years, that will make a huge or can make a huge difference in terms of whatever the world is like 100, 200, 300, 1,000 years from now. But I agree with you. We're right now, everything is based on infinite growth on a finite planet. And if that's not insane, nothing is.
Right. Your online conversation with more than 50 big names was quite an event, and it's just completed. How did that come about, and what led you to select the topics and the people?
It was really interesting. It started out just as a vision. I love having conversations with peers and with people who are passionately committed to, you know, something that I'm committed to. So 5 years ago, I did a conversation series with 38 of the world's top experts in evolutionary Christianity. So that was the title of it, The Advent of Evolutionary Christianity. And I literally interviewed the top Catholics, the top Protestants, the top evangelicals. I mean, the most respected people in various, you know, aspects of Christianity who fully embrace an ecological evolutionary worldview. So I so love that. And people, if they just Google evolutionary Christianity, they can still find that up online. That I wanted to do the same thing specifically around climate and sustainability and peak oil and some of these large-scale challenges. And so I started out just envisioning interviewing, you know, 15, 20 people via Skype, and then I ended up, it just ended up sort of growing out of control almost. So, I mean, I think virtually all the other teleconferences like this Skype interview series that that Entheos, the organization that I worked with, has done, I mean, I think the most that any of the others had were 25 or 30, and mine ended up mushrooming to 55. It was so meaningful. It was so, like, yummy that I wanted to, the title of it being The Future is Calling Us to Greatness, and, of course, if you just put The Future is Calling Us to Greatness in Google, you'll get there, too. And my intention behind it was to interview people who really get the bad news, who really get, like, the you know, that this isn't Pollyanna. This is not something we're just going to lightly move through. You know, if we survive it at all, you know, what can we do? What can we? How can we think? How can we be with our communities, with ourselves, with our families, and with whatever gifts and limitations each of us has, to make a difference, to how do we stay inspired to be in action, whatever the challenges are. And it was so meaningful that I want to actually now, like once a month, continue to interview some of the people that I, like yourself, that I didn't get a chance to interview, but have a lot to contribute on this particular topic.
That's quite a large undertaking.
Well, it was, but it was also so, it was over the course of a year. The main thing that Connie and I have been traveling North America, speaking in churches and colleges on sort of the inspiring side of science for 12 and a half years. But this last year, what gave our lives structure was the Great March for Climate Action. So we started in San Diego, and then the march itself started in Los Angeles on March 1st of last year, 2014, and then went over the course of 8 months and finished on November 1st in Washington, D.C. So Connie and I lined up about 110 speaking engagements along that route. And sometimes we were, you know, or like a week or two ahead of the marchers. Sometimes we were a week or two behind the marchers. Sometimes I was speaking at climate rallies in some of the bigger cities along the route. And but the other thing that I was doing during that whole time, I think my first interview, I think, was John Michael Greer in mid-March, and I just started interviewing people. So it was, these interviews happened over the course of 8 or 9 months, and I sort of was caught, not exactly off, I wasn't exactly surprised, but I was still blown away with the quality of the conversations, because invariably, because I'm not just sort of some newsman interviewing people, that I also am passionate about these, that I was able to ask questions and really draw out their expertise, their passion, their fears, and then sort of we sometimes spiraled each other to where probably 8 or 9 of these 55 interviews, I was literally brought to tears at one point in the conversation. And often afterwards, in fact, probably a dozen and a half times, maybe 2 dozen times, I would go into whatever room Connie was in after the Skype interview was over, and, you know, I just looked at her with my eyes wide open. I was like, damn! I mean, it was like, I was so pleased. So, yeah, I want to continue having these long, you know, far into the future.
Right, that's great. You use the word sustainability, and that word is bandied about pretty frequently. As nearly as I can tell, based on the way most people use it, it means sustaining the status quo rather than sustaining life on Earth, maintaining some sort of capitalism growth base. system.
Yeah, no, I ended up having this conversation with quite a few people. Most of us hated the word sustainability. We sort of used it, you know, as a last resort, because it's certainly not. I mean, industrial civilization cannot be sustained. The current overshoot, the way humanity is so living beyond the carrying capacity of any particular bioregion, much less the planet as a whole, is, you know, is utterly unsustainable. So I don't like the word personally. I use it as I just did, but it's, you know, there's got to be a better word. We need to come home to living within the carrying capacity, you know, of the earth, of the bioregions. And one of the things that requires is a measuring of success in non-demonic ways. I mean, I say demonic. I interpret everything in a naturalistic way. I'm a Christian naturalist. I'm a religious naturalist. I have no supernatural or otherworldly beliefs at all. And so I interpret all mythic language as saying something metaphorical or symbolic about this one reality in which we live and move and have our being. And so for me, recognizing that the only way into the future is to measure progress, to measure success in terms of how are we impacting the primary community, the community of soil, the soil organisms, the health of the soil. If, you know, there is no human progress that doesn't include the progressing of the soil. If the human, quote-unquote, human progress or human success is diminishing the soil, it's insane. It's not only not sustainable, it's demonic. It's a system. What I mean by demonic is any system of governance and economics that makes it inevitable or easy for millions of people to harm the future. I mean, if the word demonic means anything, it's got to mean that. And so, you know, measuring success in any other way that doesn't include measuring is the soil getting better over time, or at least not getting worse? Is the air, the CO2 content, you know, the water, quality of the water, the fisheries, other species? I mean, we need to measure success, human success, in terms of the success of the primary economy of the body of life upon which we, you know, utterly depend, and we're not. So I agree. It's not about sustaining this insanity that we're currently in.
Yeah, it seems, you know, for those of us, well, you know, what I call this culture, I call this the dominant culture, the dominant industrial culture. And I do that instead of humanity, because there are people who are living outside of this particular culture. That doesn't mean that they're not impacted by it or influenced by it. But like you and myself and Guy and others, they weren't necessarily born into our version of success, and what that means is, you know, to our particular culture. And so what really helped me when I was looking at your talk, and it made a connection for me, was your mismatched instincts and supernormal allurements. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it's very important to explain that and how our evolution is not matching with what we're facing today.
Yeah, and I'll be happy to. One thing just before I get to that, which is I've just been reading William Catton, who just died a month ago. His book, Overshoot, is one of the most important books I've ever read in my life. And he draws a distinction between Homo sapiens, which even he thinks that's overstated, wise human, and Homo colossus, which is where one human being lives like 20 former human beings or 30 former human beings, or, you know, like when one American lives in terms of our impact on the natural world, 20 or 30 or 40 Bangladeshis or people from India or whatever. So, yes, it's not just about population, it's about consumption as well. But anyway, coming back to your question, the last 7 years or so, the main topic until Connie and I sort of took on climate change as a front burner issue was evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science. And my first TEDx talk, as you referenced, was on that topic called Why We Struggle Now. And it was really about, you know, one of the things that religions have attempted to do is help people navigate, you know, what has been called, you know, our sinful nature, certainly in the Western traditions. I mean, basically the fact that sometimes it's not easy to live in integrity. Sometimes we get distracted or addicted or struggle, or, you know, we say we're going to do something and we do the opposite. We say we're never going to do something and we end up doing it anyway. I mean, what's that about? Why is that the case? So we have various mythic stories and understandings of that, but we now have a science-based way, which is the fact that, you know, we have mismatched instincts, that our instincts as humans are as deep and primal and have been ingrained into us and programmed for millions of years for really, really good reasons. I mean, the reason we have cravings for sugar, salts, and fats is because for 99% of human history, it wasn't easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. So having a craving for those things allowed our ancestors to survive long enough to reproduce. Yet today we're bombarded. We're absolutely surrounded by foods that have sugar, salts, and fats, yet we still have the cravings as though they were rare. So it's a mismatch. And, you know, and we now have, we're surrounded by supernormal allurements, that is, things that we would normally be allured to anyway, but they're now in concentrations or presented in ways that are damn near irresistible. So, you know, we're surrounded by drugs, alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, video games, shopping, internet porn, romance novels, social networking sites, news, as you guys were talking about at the beginning. And these are things that we're programmed to pay attention to, but now they're in irresistible forms. And so many of us and our children and our grandchildren, if we're old enough, you know, struggle with some of this. And so understanding what's driving us and why allows us to have, instead of being confused or feeling guilty about our mismatched instincts and the fact that we're sometimes out of integrity as a result, or waste our time, or waste, you know, hurt other people, that we can have this experience of like, oh, of course, we can have compassion for ourselves and others. And this is what we found over the last 7 years. Connie and I have found that when people really get what's driving them and why from our best science-based perspective, it allows them to appreciate these older mythic ways of speaking about it, but it also sort of evaporates the confusion, the guilt, the anger, so we can begin to have a deeper compassion for ourselves, for each other. We can have difficult conversations where before we were ashamed to do so, because it sort of removes the shame and blame and makes the healing happen better and or more rapidly. And ultimately, in my experience and the experience of many, many people I've interacted with, having this evolutionary understanding of our nature, our mismatched instincts, and the fact that we're living in a world of supernormal allurements also helps us make sense of some of the collective stuff, the collective stupidity in terms of our governance, but also the way of doing economics, you know, this idea that, you know, we're all just motivated by self-centeredness, but we're, you know, clueless to the fact that we're also motivated by status and wanting to, you know, I mean, there's just all these other things. So having an understanding actually sheds light in a fresh way on our collective issues, our individual issues, and hopefully it will eventually, maybe not before some kind of a collapse, but it will help us, you know, redo policy so that whatever emerges on the, you know, as we move through into a dark age, and whatever emerges out of that, hopefully we will have learned from the utter mistakes that we've made in terms of human nature, and part of that comes from this global collective intelligence. I mean, that's what science is. It's global collective intelligence about what's real and what's important.
Yeah, it seems to me once you become aware of the story you tell yourself about yourself or the story we tell ourselves about ourselves, it is, for me and those people that I associate with, it's very freeing, as you say, and it's like this weight has been lifted off. And people wonder the why I took the path I took and why I live in a Mongolian yurt and why I talk about these things. But really, the big part of that is becoming aware of that story that narrative that was running through my head about how I am and how I should be and how the culture should be and how things should be instead of the way things are.
Well, exactly. And what you're pointing to, Mike, is I think something that's vital for almost everybody, which is that part of living in right relationship to reality is really being present to what's real, not so much your story about what's real, how you interpret. Being able to distinguish what's real from your interpretation is a really vital thing, because as I'm sure both of you know, and probably many of your listeners as well, is that, you know, the thing that will determine the quality of a person's life isn't what happens to them, it's how they interpret what happens to them. And so developing some skill in interpreting and also having that larger perspective. I mean, I appreciated when you started talking about Mary Pfeiffer and the, you know, her writings and so, sort of how she stays inspired. Two of the things that weren't mentioned in that I found hugely useful. One is a larger sense of identification, that
knowing this great story or epic of evolution or the universe, you know, universe story or what's now called big history in academic circles, the sense that humans aren't separate from nature. We're not separate from the universe, that we are the universe becoming conscious of itself. I mean, nature has been unfolding and complexifying for 13.8 billion years, and then in this solar system, the universe began to become complex enough that it could begin to contemplate its own nature. So we are the universe becoming conscious of itself. We're a piece of nature uncovering its own nature, but we've been living thinking that we're separate from nature and that we could control it and dominate it, and so that's the insane part. And so part of that is that larger identification, like the Earth is my larger body, it's my larger self, the Milky Way is my larger body, the universe is my larger body, allows me to play my role and to do so passionately with joy and you know, enthusiasm, but I'm also recognizing that in the same way that each of the cells in my body, my kidney cells, my heart cells, my toe cells, you know, they all die into the process, and yet I continue to live. So I'm going to live my life, I'm going to die, but my larger body, my larger self continues to live. So that's one of the things that gives me hope or allows me to stay inspired. The other one is having a deep time perspective, that when you recognize over millions and billions of years, you know, I love that John Michael Greer wrote a post years ago called The Next 10 Billion Years. And I've got to say, I mean, there's so many of you that I enjoy reading, but the Archdruid, I've read 10 of his books in the last 2 years. And one of his blog posts that I just loved was he talked about, you know, at most, if assuming we survive the next, you know, century or two, which is not a guaranteed thing, but if we do, humans will last a couple million years, you know, and then he thinks that, as Connie, my wife, does, that the next self-reflexive intelligence is likely to be raccoons, and, you know, because they've got the manual dexterity for tools. And then, you know, they'll last at most a few million years, and the next self-reflexive intelligence is likely to be corvids. And I loved it because he talked about, you know, the great existential crisis of the crows, the corvids, is that they'll end up reaching the moon and discover that some species on Earth beat them to it, you know. But having that larger perspective of identification with the larger body of life and identifying with this deep sense of time allows me to be passionately committed to ensuring a healthy future, including some form of healthy humanity, but do so without being attached, recognizing that you know, we may or may not make it. This truly may be near-term extinction. It may be that, you know, but you know, hey, 99% of human, you know, or 99% of all the species that have ever existed aren't here now. So we're playing our role, we're doing our thing, and yes, I'm going to do everything I can, given my gifts and passion and inclinations, to ensure that some form of humanity survives and that some form of healthy religion, that is pro-science, pro-nature, pro-future religion, you know, survives the dark age. But, you know, I don't know whether that's going to be the case or not, but I don't fret about it, even though I sometimes do have anguish that my kids and grandkids could very well be among those who, you know, who die as we are in, you know, the die-off of Overshoot.
Speaking of Overshoot, I know you're a fan of recently deceased academic William Catton, as am I. His 1980 book, Overshoot, delineated how deeply we're into human population overshoot. Of course, we've been there since development of the first civilizations on Earth, so I would argue Catton was a few millennia late in describing our dire straits. So how do we deal with overshoot beyond the gradual changes proposed by Catton and many others since then? And here I'm thinking about things like carbon tax to deal with climate change and political actions to deal with birth control, for example.
Yeah. Well, I think all those are important, and who knows? I mean, it's like, you know, as with anything else, we need to do what we can that's in the direction that we feel in our guts and our hearts and our souls, to that kind of language, is the right direction. That is the healthful direction, the pro-future direction. But ultimately, Connie and I are both emergentists. We trust emergence. With emergence, you can't necessarily know what's going to unfold. So you try to do the right thing now. And, you know, there are so many systems that are out of right relationship to reality. There are so many systems that are anti-future. There's so many systems that are so anthropocentric, human-centered, that, you know, I don't know. Well, what I do know is that things like taxing carbon,
things like perhaps even shifting, like Naomi Klein talks about in her new book, This Changes Everything, which is a great book. We need to think a lot more radically about our ways of doing economics than just taxing carbon. I mean, there's so much of this rapacious, extractive, industrial way of being, and just our even ways of doing money, our doing ways of economics, are seemingly inherently self-destructive of the natural world. So there has to be much more radical changes. But as John Michael Greer makes the point a lot, radical changes take time. And, you know, I do find that we're in the, you know, we're, I think, thoroughly through abundance industrialism. I think we're well into the decades of scarcity industrialism, which could last, you know, another 50, 60, 70, 100 years, assuming humans survive, which is not a guaranteed thing. But if we do, I think there'll be scarcity economy then, where we basically just, you know, sort of scrap, you know, where we salvage the stuff, and hopefully... The vision, at least, that inspires me is what he calls the ecotechnic future. And it could very well be 500 million people or less. It could be less than, a billion people. It's certainly, given climate patterns and, you know, if these, you know, methane plumes just exacerbate and, you know, and there's not some, you know, shifting of the, you know, like... I don't know. I mean, one of the interesting things is when you get paleoecology, there have been times when the methane has been released at a very rapid rate, and we saw, you know, 15 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, rise in temperature, and then that triggered a shifting of ocean climates, which then rapidly or fairly rapidly were able to cool things again. So it's, I don't think we know enough to know that we're truly at the end of Permian-like extinction where 90% of the species goes out. We might be there, but I think it's just as possible that we will see some kind of trimming down where we'll see a billion, maybe 2 billion, maybe a half a billion, maybe less than that. But again, one of the things we know is that Earth does this. I mean, the last supervolcano that went off anywhere in the world was 72,000 years ago, Toba in Indonesia, and something like 8,000 human beings survived, you know. And might there be that few humans 100 years from now, or 50 years from now, or 200 years from now, or 500 years from now? I don't know. But what I do know is that I'm going to damn sure do everything I can to ensure that some kind of virus, memes, some ideas that are so memorable they can be chanted, they can be sung, they can be remembered easily and passed on, that really embodies a healthy religiosity, a religiosity that can take many different forms. It can take a Muslim form, or a Christian form, a Buddhist form, or an atheist form, but it's all about living in a honorable relationship to reality, honoring the future, being a blessing to the future, being of service to the future, and only living in the present in a way that doesn't diminish the future. So we're concerned with the health of the soil, the health of the air, the health of the water, and so on. But yeah, how we get from here to there, God only knows. And I don't mean God as a supernatural being. I'm just using that as a saying.
Right. Well,
Toba life knows. As you know, the whole nature bats last. I mean, the only thing that I'm not crazy about your starting theme song there is that I like the Julia Roberts. I don't know if you've seen the natureisspeaking.org videos. There's now 8 videos that have gone viral. Millions of people have watched these videos. They can all be found at natureisspeaking.org. And Julia Roberts personifies nature. And I love the fact that, you know, they keep coming back to humans need nature. You know, nature doesn't need humans. Humans need nature. And, you know, I think Julia Roberts makes a fabulous Mother Nature, but I don't think nature is pissed off at us. I think nature is just nature. But, yeah, nature bats last. That is, we either come into alignment with nature or we're broken on nature. We're you know. But I think it's a little bit too much anthropomorphism that I don't think is necessarily helpful to think that Mother Nature is just, you know, pissed off at us and, you know, going to punish us because we're bad children. I think we're doing what, this is what Milliam Catton makes the point. We're just doing what all species do. It's just that we're now waking up to the consequences of it, and that's horrific. That's scary.
Yes, there are consequences. And we're out of time. I need to mention right before we wrap up here that Toba, if it occurred, was a cooling event, and we as large mammals can handle cooling no problem, but there's considerable evidence that Toba was a myth that has been widely perpetuated. In any event, thank you, Michael, for taking time to join us today and for your excellent thoughts.
We appreciate it, Mike.
Thank you, Guy, and thank you, Mike. I appreciate this, and I'd beg to differ on the Toba thing, but that's a conversation we can have offline.
Right.
Yes. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.
All right. So we have a climate update.
And before that, we have a Doomer of the Week.
Oh, we do have a Doomer of the Week.
Yes,
woo-hoo!
We do have a Doomer of the Week. How could we not? Each week we seek out a Doomer who goes beyond the status quo and provides some important insight. Our Doomer for this week is Deba Kale Earnshaw, who posted the following comment in a thread on the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group page on Facebook. Quote, I suppose people have to be coaxed into understanding where we are at, and that's kind of hard to do, given there's no fairy tale ending. We have to give people a goal, something to try for. Living out our lives in the here and now, being kind to our loved ones and other animals, it's a turnaround in thinking from the future-based way we were brought up. But it's all we can do now. And then on to a climate change update. We have a very important news bit about climate change this week, as well as a historical note that I thought was worthy of mention. From the online edition of Slate last Wednesday, February 4th, comes this headline. Even the architects of the next UN climate change agreement are pessimistic. Eric Holthaus writes at Slate, heartbreaking news Wednesday on that whole global warming thing. Two of the leading architects of a major United Nations agreement on climate, scheduled to be agreed upon this December, are trying to soften expectations. This is particularly disappointing because Paris had previously been billed as the most important negotiation since the failure in Copenhagen in 2009. Miguel Arias Cañete, the climate chief of the European Union, was in Washington this week for talks on climate change with the lead of the U.S. delegation, Todd Stern. He was quoted in The Guardian as saying, if we have an ongoing process, you cannot say it is a failure if the mitigation commitments do not reach 2 degrees C. Actually, you can, because keeping climate change to less than 2 degrees Celsius, the arbitrary point at which scientists and world governments have agreed is the start of dangerous interference with the climate system, is the entire goal of the UN climate negotiations. That's it. That's what the world is fighting for. All the eggs have been put in that basket. But wait, there's more, also from The Guardian. In Brussels, meanwhile, the top UN climate official, Cristiana Figueres, was similarly downplaying expectations, telling reporters the pledges made in the run-up to the Paris meeting later this year will, quote, not get us onto the 2 degree C pathway. Now, I don't know about you, but that doesn't seem very hopeful. I mean, honestly, what is the point of even conducting these talks if your boss says 10 months in advance that you will fail? That's all from the article. That's all quoted from the article and points out that 10 months in advance we're going to fail. Well, of course we're going to fail at 2 degree C because 2 degree C is locked in even if industrial civilization collapses tomorrow because of the global dimming associated with sulfates we put into the atmosphere. 2 degrees C has been behind us for a long time. Propping that up as a goal is ludicrous, and now several organizations and individuals have given up on that goal. On the historical front, 50 years ago this month, U.S. President Lyndon Baines Johnson voiced concern over invisible fossil fuel emissions in a special message to Congress. It was the first time a U.S. president warned the nation about our carbon habit. As you can now tell, that solved that problem, didn't it?
Oh, the great pretender. Well, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bats Labs and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Labs on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and his upcoming speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm and rate us on iTunes. And thanks again to all our excellent contributions this week and to Afrozen for the music and our guest, Michael Dowd. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species a day to extinction. We're about to see that turn around. The loving planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news. She, that's right.